Reality Check, a weekly podcast about anything and everything having to do with education. I'm Jeannie Allen. I'm the CEO and founder of the Center for Education Reform, where we've been working for almost 25 years to expand education opportunity and innovation. Reality Check is a production of National Review, and I am delighted to be sitting in National Review Studios today in New York City as we engage in a fantastic conversation with Michael Block of Basis Schools. So first of all, before I get to Michael, I want to encourage anyone who's listening today to subscribe to Reality Check at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn so that every week you'll be sure to get the latest Reality Check podcast delivered right to your computer. So why Reality Check? We chose the name because a lot of what you read about education these days is often wrong or misleading. And if you really want to know what's going on in America's schools, from preschool to graduate school, you are going to need a reality check. So today, my guest is someone who can actually help American students, American families, right, Michael, and political leaders understand what really happens and what can happen to make education work for all kids. He's half of a husband and wife team, which has, as the Phoenix Business Journal put it, taken the charter school movement to a new level. Michael and Olga Block both have PhDs in economics, he from Stanford, she from Cornell, which actually helped set up, and I want to talk about this, setting up Basis Schools, which today is a network of 27 public, private, and international schools around the country. Fantastic. Just so hard to believe in all this time, in 25 years, you've been able to do that kind of work, actually less than that. However, even just having those schools and with Michael's background, it doesn't begin to explain why four of the top five high schools in the U.S. are basic schools. So they're obviously doing something right, and I am so delighted to have Michael Block here to help describe what it is that's led to their success. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, and I'm very glad to be here. And actually, we've grown since that text was prepared.
Wow.
We now have 32 schools this year.
Fantastic.
Around the world.
That's just amazing. So for people listening that may have had great schools in their neighborhood, may have themselves experienced those as students, maybe some of them are challenged, like most American parents and families, by a misfit for education. Let's start with your story and why you decided to do this. Did you see a problem? And if so, what was it?
Yes, and we have what we call a founding myth. As Olga put it, she's a European, and as she put it, every institution has to have a founding myth. And our founding myth is, Olga started with me, Basis, for her daughter, who came here as a middle school student. And that's partially true. Olga actually put her daughter in a series of suburban schools, rated as great schools, and was shocked, actually, at the lack of content and organization in the curriculum, and very pleased at sort of the American classroom experience, but found it empty. And it struck a very sympathetic note because I taught at the university for more years than I like to admit, and I taught economics. And almost every time I had a class that had students educated outside the United States, they did better than the best American students. And I actually refuse to think that was because there's a different distribution of talent.
Right.
It had to do with their education. They were better educated in pre-college years. And so Olga and I came together, and we really came together as education reformers in the most fundamental sense. We weren't social activists.
Mm-hmm.
We're not social workers. Mm-hmm. We're essentially interested in creating great education and creating a school, a preparatory school, that's as good as any in the world. And that was our objective.
And so interesting, because you say as a professor, you saw and experienced firsthand this level of education other countries were then and likely still today, right? We're not educating our students to the same level as those from other countries. We hear and see surveys all the time of college professors, employers still saying the same thing. So what have you identified? So it was a lack of preparation, and does it also speak to what you all did? You said Olga's feeling was that the American school experience was nice, but it was empty. And then you all created something called deep content. So is the difference between us and them content?
It's partially content, and it's largely attitudinal. That is that school is work, and that there isn't an absolutely painless way to acquire a good education. You do have to work. So it is partially attitudinal, and there is a substance difference. The standards are much higher. I mean, when you're willing to work, then you're willing to accept much higher standards.
Right.
And the emphasis at BASIS has always been on hard work. You know, we take students, whatever their hardware, and we try to do the software. And so we just fill in the gaps if we have to, but they have to be able to work.
It's so well put. And, you know, this was your first school, was in Tucson, Arizona in
1998.
So we are almost 20 years. And just in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of talk through best-selling books, people like Professor Angela Duckworth, about grit and perseverance and hard work, as if those were new, not taking anything away from Angela Duckworth. She's amazing. She's written this out. But it sounds like you all came to a pretty straightforward conclusion way back when that folks are just today recognizing as a key indicator of success.
Yeah, I think that's very much why we have been successful, is that we did very early on in this movement, but not early on in human experience, recognize that hard work and perseverance and failure is important. I mean, I was in Guangzhou for the opening of a school, of a BASIS school, in September. And one of our teachers there gave a presentation, which I thought was quite adventurous in China, because we don't fully understand the culture. But he made a point that the most important part of a BASIS education is failing. That you have to fail early on and recover. And the ability to rebound from that and to learn from your failures is really very important.
And so why don't most U.S. schools do that? Or am I making an assumption that they don't?
I only observe this indirectly, but there is this attempt to make the students feel good by high grades all the time. And then failure is seen as this tragedy. And in China, actually, where you would think that because of this reputation of a rigid culture, that failure would be looked upon as really shameful, it turns out that they've adopted the Silicon Valley approach. And so that resonated. I was shocked. I didn't know how this was going to go. But this sort of resonated with the Chinese parents that, yeah, that's what we always hear about Silicon Valley.
That's exactly right. My child is an honor student, right? Is that the same the same idea? I mean, but years ago, it was interesting. Years ago, there was this study done by professor, I want to say his name was Stevenson, about international and, again, U.S. students, and they did tests and assessments, and this will come to me after we're done, Michael, of course, but they, after assessing students and getting the scores back, they asked both, and I think it was Asian students and American students, this is Harold Stevenson, possibly, and the Asian students said, they said, how do you think you did? And they said, not too well, and they asked the U.S. students, how do you think you did? And they said, oh, really well. Well, it turns out the Asian students did very well, and the U.S. students didn't, so their opinions were higher, even if their scores weren't.
Yeah, I mean, Americans are self-confident, and that's good if it's based on something. Again, in this genre that you're talking about is the Stossel piece, several years ago, Stupid in America,
yes,
where essentially the Americans were so confident in their abilities but came out way behind the Belgian students. And this is something that's pretty well known. I mean, if you look at the OECD tests, the PISA tests, the Americans are best in the middle, and worrisome, they have smaller percentage of top-performing students than many of the leading countries. It's not only the average that's lower, it's the top-performing students percentage is much lower.
Right, exactly. So our top performing students still pale in comparison, right, to the top performing students of other countries, and there's fewer of them.
There's fewer of them. It's hard to tell from that data whether the few that we have are not comparable. They probably are. It's just this number is smaller.
Okay, so you're an economist by training. Some people, I mean, I think everyone goes, that's awful, and then they go back to their families and homes and go, everything's great here. But why does it matter, right? Even those of us who have been fortunate, because I want to get to the whole point of this exercise also is to help those who don't have access to better schools, who can't just pick up and move to another neighborhood that supposedly has higher performing schools. I still argue that it's their stock. It's not their better performing. It's that we happen to send our kids better prepared. And those schools, just as a little aside, say, oh, my gosh, we're doing so great. No, you have my kids, right? So forget that piece. But you don't have the money to be able to do that. You don't have the access to a private school in those cases. So we want to talk about the underprivileged, the less fortunate. But hold on there for a second. Why does it even matter for our better performing kids? Like, why should people care that our schools aren't as rigorous as they should be?
Okay. And this is a good question. And it's a question that was addressed indirectly, at least, by Andreas Schleicher, who runs the PISA program for OECD, really an expert now on international comparisons and on workforce readiness. And his point is, well, you know, the Americans do better with any amount of resources that they have than almost anyone on earth. And he's not an American. And he's sitting there in Paris and saying that, okay, the Americans can execute. And that's very true. The problem is, I think we've been very successful in convincing the rest of the world to change their systems to better mimic ours. And now, going into the 21st century, we're going to have more competition. And yes, we can execute better, but you can only make up for so much. Mm-hmm. And the current workforce is really deficient in mathematical and analytical skills. I mean, it's worse than just mathematics. I mean, analysis is gone. And that's another problem about propaganda in the schools. But
well, you know, I had a guest recently, Ulrich Christensen, and his whole work from Area 9 company, but his whole work is around adaptive learning. And we talked a lot about math and the fundamental building blocks and why that's important. Again, we have a lot of people walking around who, for whatever reason, didn't do well. And we can talk about teacher preparation. We can talk about whether the content was right. But they assume they don't need that math in everyday life. But people forget it's a building block.
Yeah, I mean, we at BASIS have this prohibition about saying, I don't do math. It's like saying, I don't do English. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a basic building block. And we've concentrated on that really from day one. And we've been very successful in the math program. I mean, we have plenty of students at the top, but I think what Olga and I are both most proud of is we don't leave students behind in math. You just don't get an opportunity to drop out of this.
Right.
And so every student that graduates from BASIS has to take calculus in either the 10th or 11th grade. So getting a student ready to take it in the 10th grade requires that you have a pretty rigorous program, but we also have the constraint we can't lose people. We can't lose students.
So my nemesis, Randy Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers, one of the teachers' unions, would say, well, of course they can do that. They pick and choose their kids. We take everyone, and we have poor kids, and we have kids that come to school hungry, and we have everyone, and we take kids no matter what, and they can pick and choose, or their parents are just smarter. And their parents, because they're smarter, their kids must be smarter. Help me parse that comment, or is it mythology?
Well, part of it is, if we take our own example, as you pointed out, we started this school in Tucson, Arizona. We had no reputation. These were two pointy heads, two academics with no reputation in the area. Nobody serious trusted us in the beginning. So for the first 4 or 5 years, we had very, very poor students in the school, both in terms of material, possessions, and in terms of preparation. And we ignored their backgrounds, absolutely ignored their backgrounds. and their supposed abilities and just went at it. Some students dropped out. I mean, that's the case. So our position was always to give students the opportunity to do this. And really, if you work hard, there's a huge range of abilities that can excel. But you have to be willing to work at it. And so we've had experience with poor children and with poorly prepared children and broken homes and students who were homeless. Now, the truth is that what happens when you're successful is that successful parents seek you out. Well, I can't tell them they can't come. Mm-hmm. We use lottery in the schools, mm-hmm. but that's just the way it is.
Right. But so do those poor parents, right? And so
they have a chance.
They have a chance. And the key is to have more chances, right? And to not have to actually be one of 7,000 kids on a waiting list or 20,000, as in some cases, for 300 slots or 500 slots. That's actually always the irony when I hear the comment, well, there's not enough choices. Well, great, let's create more. Why are you fighting the opportunity for people to have that opportunity, right? So you mentioned Tucson. I remember years ago, not to wax nostalgic about it. First of all, you make it sound really easy. And I think for anyone listening, with 32 schools open now, nationally, internationally, public, charter, and private and international and charter, you make it sound easy. But back in the day when you started in Tucson, as you said, people thought you were just a couple pointy heads, and what did you know? And they did things like change the zoning rules on you so that your parents couldn't drive up and drop off their kids. Talk about some of those obstacles that you had to overcome that were really petty and how adults behave when you challenge their power.
It really, the beginning of BASIS was really interesting. So Olga and I got a charter. We went out looking for a place to locate the school, and there was a bank at the time that was offering favorable terms for leasing through tax-free bonds. And we found a very nice place in a residential area of Tucson, and it reminded Olga of, sort of a European villa. And we convinced the leasing company, the bank, to buy the property. We got a letter from the zoning administrator that we could put a school there. And then we were at the property one day. The neighbors happened, one of the couple worked at Tucson schools. And we didn't know anything about it. And we just told them what we were going to do. And the news trucks were at our house that afternoon. And from that time through about the next 3 months, the actual town of Tucson or the city of Tucson managed to change the zoning laws and the traffic laws so that we couldn't use the piece of property. And we essentially had to find a rented space. And we were renting space then when we started from a local Jewish temple that was underutilized, their Saturday school or Sunday school, whatever. Right. So we started in rented quarters. We couldn't actually open up. We had, at the time we convinced the bank to lease us this property, we had 120 students in the pre-enrollment stage. We opened with 56. So that controversy cost us more than half the students.
Right. As it normally does. And this is the interesting thing. When the public charter school movement has been in existence for just over 26 years now. For people who aren't familiar with it, right? These are public schools of choice, open by choice, accountable for results for a contract, not to a district, and in most states, free from things like contracts and unions and things like that. Although, in recent years, as we know, there's more and more bureaucracy and requirements because people keep wanting to put
positive innovation in the box today.
No, you couldn't. In fact, if you walked in, they'd call you crazy. I like to say, think about an Eva Moskowitz at Success Academies, a Mike Feinberg at KIPP. They'd be like, who are you? What do you know about starting a school? And in fact, the innovators, the entrepreneurs, the great crazy thought leaders that went on to do something amazing got to do it because there wasn't this bureaucracy and this push. Be that as it may, so many schools open up and go out of business, not initially because they're doing poorly, but because the bureaucracy and the politics around it are challenging you. So imagine hiring teachers, trying to enroll kids, and then fighting these wars when you're trying to actually focus on the student. I mean, are we ever going to get over this?
I don't think so. I mean, we still have it. So, I mean, I think the public school districts still try whatever they can. They're now competing, which is better than trying to use the political process. So
right.
I noticed that University High, which is really a very good public high school in Tucson, which is usually nationally rated, mm-hmm. they've expanded now. They're recruiting. Okay. They've changed their program so that they give APs earlier. They've tried to mimic a lot of what we've done, which is nice in theory. It's a little difficult in practice because we have to compete with them.
Right.
But I appreciate the fact that it does evolve somewhat. I mean, I think there is more competition now and sort of less attempt to undermine us.
And there is the potential for innovation and those kind of changes in a traditional school or school district when you actually utilize new methods, right? When you maybe deploy technologies, when you actually try to break some China.
I am actually pretty pessimistic, though, about the public system. You know, I have a lot of gray hair, as you can see. Maybe the listeners can. And I actually grew up when I was very young in New York City and then grew up outside of New York City. And I can remember when there was a great deal of deference to the boards of education, the elected boards. Mm-hmm. They were generally accomplished people in the community. I grew up in a little town in upstate New York. No one would think of challenging the board. The people on the board were not particularly political. So it worked, mm-hmm. as long as there wasn't too much direct democracy in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the logic of this, it's really not possible, I think, in this day and age, to have excellent public schools because there's too much interest group politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too politicized, and there's no way to forget that. You can't roll that back. So you have to find new forms. The charters are a form. I would prefer there also be vouchers,
mm-hmm.
because I just don't think, I have not much hope for the public schools.
It's kind of like saying Washington can be functional.
Yeah.
So tell me about vouchers, more about vouchers and what they do.
Well, you know, there was an experiment recently in Arizona, but it's very small, of unconditional vouchers. So you don't send your children to public school. You get a voucher that you can use in private schools or parochial schools, which is even more controversial.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually not the full amount that the state spends on education, so there's some budget savings. And it gives people an opportunity to get away from the public system. I just think the public system can't produce excellence on a regular basis. I mean, New York has improved, and it has improved because they centralized the decision-making in the mayor and took it out of a politicized board.
Right.
I'm not sure it's lasting here.
Right.
And I'm not sure it's durable.
Because it changes every time the politics change.
Yeah.
Like in Washington, D.C., we had a mayor, mayoral control. They hired famous Michelle Reed. She came in and challenged the status quo, and things changed. And then we have a new mayor, and they want to collaborate and more uniformly do our work together. We even have 47% of our kids in charters. We have a small voucher program. But everyone's always trying to go back and up the system and improve it without realizing that what that takes is independent free thinkers who are accountable but have the freedom to dream and to do great things like you guys have, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the public era is over. So, okay.
So, I think, you know what, that's why we're here to talk about these things. I think it's important for people to realize. And you talk about fit, right? So at the beginning, before we started, you were talking about your two new schools in New York, one that's open, one that's going to be opening.
Both are open.
Both are open. Okay. So tell us about those schools and really kind of come full circle. These 32 schools are about people finding the right fit for their students.
Right. And we manage charters and international schools, and we manage and operate independent schools, fee-paying schools or tuition-paying schools. I do like the independence that you get in tuition-paying schools, and it's a new experience for us because even though the consumers aren't franchised in a charter model, it's not quite as strong as when you have skin in the game, right, like a private school. So there are new challenges for us and new abilities to be independent from any curriculum control. I have to say Arizona is very good on curriculum control. I mean, that's why we prospered there. We have schools in Texas. They're pretty good. They also have some issues. We're moving to Louisiana now. We have a school in D.C. They're all pretty good, but there's always this boundary.
Right.
And so in an independent school, the only constraint really is, can you attract parents?
Because the laws vary so much, and the laws are also challenged on a regular basis. A lot of people don't realize that schools like yours, basis schools, are actually political animals in the sense that they only can occur because someone changed a law somewhere. Someone improved a law, and so many states still don't have that. I mean, what, we have maybe 6% of our kids nationwide even have some access to a publicly funded choice, private or public through a public charter. It's astonishing in a country as large and great as ours that freedom is not ubiquitous, right?
Not ubiquitous. I can remember a report that came out of it, and I don't remember the think tank in Washington called Cowboy Charters.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And it was, you know, this relatively negative review of the Arizona charter law because it sort of undid so many of the shibboleths about what's necessary. And I think Olga and I could not have started anywhere else. And I'm not sure we could start even in Arizona today.
And now, think about it, was cowboy charters. I actually think those were colleagues or frenemies, as we like to call them, who called it that. And now the data shows what? That, in fact, of all the students in Arizona, lower-income kids of color, perform better than any other public school students because of charters.
Because of charters.
It's pretty astonishing. All right, one final word about teachers, because at the heart of this, if you don't have great teachers, you can't have great schools. Is that true?
That is true.
How do you make a great teacher?
Well, we use I think part of the magic sauce for us is to create something we call creative tension in the classroom between the teacher and the rules of engagement. So the rules of engagement are really the curriculum. So we have a curriculum that is uniform throughout all basis curriculum schools, that we now call them basis curriculum schools. And that curriculum is more or less crowdsourced by the best teachers in our network. It's not that detailed, but it does specify topics to be covered and skills. And then we put in the classroom from grade one now, which is very unique, subject experts. People who love their subject. So it's true that professors love their subject too, but teaching in college is self-indulgent.
Right.
And teaching in a college prep, you really need to be more constrained. So we have this curriculum that constrains you, and then we have the talented, energetic teachers who are really masters of their subject, and they find ways to excite the students about their subject and teach it. And I think that's the magic. You have to find those people, though, who are excited about their subject and willing to confront the curriculum. And so, and I think the wonders is really in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
We have a two-teacher model in elementary school. We have a subject expert and a learning expert in every classroom. And the subject experts so excite the kids that learning for many of these young kids becomes sort of consumption.
Right.
They really like it.
They like it.
And then you got them.
That's the key. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me today. This was way too brief. Michael Block is co-founder with his wife, Olga, of Basis Curriculum Schools, which are setting a hugely high bar for schools of any sort. Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this edition of Reality Check, a production of National Review. And don't forget, the latest podcast can always be found at National Review Online or subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, who knows what that is, but you guys can find out about there. And tune in, and please don't ever miss an episode. I'm Jeannie Allen. I look forward to exploring the world of education, innovation, opportunity with you and another prominent guest next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you for being here.